Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein with your Clubland Q&A live around the planet. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 in Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 9 p.m. in the British Isles, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in the Middle East, midnight in Moscow, the early hours of Wednesday morning in Asia, and it's a little bit early for the kippers and kedgeree in Australia, but we hope you're up and about and joining us on the air. Slightly more convivial hour for breakfasting in New Zealand and beyond. But it is great to have you with us. The Mark Stein Club is celebrating its second birthday. Wasn't sure I was going to be here or anywhere in particular 2 years ago, so I'm thrilled to be here. Glad tons of you are re-upped for the third year. And you don't have to be a club member to listen to this. You can listen to it for free anywhere on the planet. But if you're a member, you get to ask questions. So if you join between now and 5 p.m. North American Eastern, that is 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, if you want to work it out from there, we'll try and rush your first question onto the air. We are having fun celebrating our birthday in the club. We have some more special features for you of various natures. If you haven't yet seen the first part of my interview with George Papadopoulos, that is up there on the Stein Online homepage, and we should be talking about that on today's Q&A. The second part contains some really quite shocking moments of what the impact of this deep state entrapment by high-level deep state players, not just in the United States, but in America's closest allies too. The impact this had on George Papadopoulos, and that will be coming up in part two of my interview with him on the Mark Stein Show, which I think airs Monday. Ahead of that, we have some other audio diversions of a less alarming nature coming up as we celebrate 2 years of the Mark Stein Club. And we will be talking today. If there's things you don't like about the club, if there's things you think we should be doing, things you think we shouldn't be doing, then do let me know, because I love to have questions on that. If you think we shouldn't be doing these Clubland Q&As, get your question in, get your statement of dissatisfaction in now, and we can end it in 15 minutes, and Laurie and Joe and the rest of the gang can all go home early, and I can sit here sobbing my heart out at what a fiasco this has been. But on the other hand, if you do like me on the radio, then next week will be a busy week for me. So let's have at it with your questions, both about whither the Mark Stein Club and actually the very disturbing implications on what has actually happened in the so-called Russia investigation, which is now itself being investigated by the Attorney General of the United States. Paul Cathy says, George Papadopoulos is entirely credible. His forthright, candid responses to Mark's questions are a fresh contrast to the shifty, evasive non-answer answers one usually hears from public life political people. It is providential that Mark, with his unique gifts and wide acquaintance, even extending to some of the crucial players in this malicious affair, is perfectly placed to eliminate any shred of credibility that Robert Mueller and his minions may once have had. Drop the hammer, Mark. I'm interested in this because I think it's actually, it's at one, I think as someone said in one of the comments earlier today, it's simply because of the magnitude of the implications that people don't actually want to confront the reality of what's going on here. It's easier to believe than that Vladimir Putin is using Macedonian content farmers to persuade American rubes to switch their votes from Hillary to Trump than the cold, grim reality of what actually happened, which is that Donald Trump's campaign was the target of a surveillance operation by the government of the United States. The government of the United States decided to put its political opponents under surveillance. Shame on you, Brennan. Shame on you, Clapper. And shame on you, Obama. Because I'm not persuaded that the authorization for this didn't have to go to the highest level. That's basic Banana Republic stuff, right? When the government decides to put its political opposition under surveillance. That's disturbing. Now, what's even more disturbing, and is what I talk about with George Stephanopoulos, by the way, his book, Deep State Target, is a cracking read. He writes it very well. Don't know whether it's one of these ghost-written things or whatever, but if it is, it's actually written very brilliantly in this very vivid present tense terse style. It's a brisk read, it's an easy read, and it gets you up to speed on what's actually going on. Because it's not enough that the government uses its most sinister bureaucracies with the most awesome powers to do what it's doing, but that in order to cover its own posterior, as the American vernacular has it, in order to cover its own posterior, it outsourced a lot of the dirty work to its closest allies, including senior figures in the United Kingdom and Australia. And that's kind of disturbing too, because it conjures this image of a tight little group of highly sophisticated intelligence agencies with virtually unlimited powers, basically conducting operations that are not even. I cannot think why it would be in the interests of David Cameron's ministry in the United Kingdom. I forget which Australian Prime Minister was the Prime Minister of the Week back then. Assuredly it was Mr. Turnbull, or Mr. Turnbull's in Canberra. I do not understand on what circumstances you could be so persuaded that Hillary Clinton is such a shoo-in that it would be that it would be prudent for you to embark on a spying operation against a major party nominee in the United States. Bizarre, but also profound in its implications, because if it's not cut down and if there are not consequences to that, then it will happen again. And who's to know? If you're up against, let's say, as I've always said, if they were doing this kind of stuff against Jeb, and accused Jeb of colluding with the Russians, Jeb's the sort of guy who would have said 2 months into the investigation, well, I don't really know what I did wrong, but I think in the interests of national unity, it'd be best if I just resign. Whatever it is that I did, I'm sorry if I did it or I didn't do it. I don't really know whether I did it or I didn't do it, but whatever it is I did or didn't do, in the interests of national unity and healing the nation, I think I'll go now. And the only guy who would have been so outraged about this to play smash mouth and push back against the banana republification, but banana republicanization of the United States would have been Donald Trump. Chris Hall, a.k.a. MCF. If you don't know what MCF is, it's Macedonian Content Farmers. I think it's their union. They've got a union now. Anyway, Chris Hall says, so let me get this straight. George Papadopoulos heads to London and gets invited to be a director of Universal Exports, but doesn't know that he should really be using Moscow rules. You're quite right. That's a funny way of putting it, Chris. For those of you who don't know your Ian Fleming, Universal Exports is James Bond's cover when he happens to be out and about in the world. You know, if he lands in Miami or he lands in Istanbul or wherever, he has a business card that says he's James Bond from Universal Exports. And it's Ian Fleming at his best, because it's a brilliant name. for the kind of cover that a spy would be using. And that's, in effect, what happened to George Papadopoulos. George Papadopoulos went to London, and hardly has he set foot, hardly is he out of Heathrow and headed downtown, then he is invited, in effect, to come and work for what's it called? The London Centre for International Law Practice or something. And it's full of all these well-connected spooks. And it doesn't actually practice. It claims to be the London Centre for International Law, and it doesn't actually practice any international law. So whatever its cover is entirely false. But he doesn't know that at the time. It just sounds like, oh, I'm being invited to join an international law practice. That's a bit odd. I don't actually practice law. Oh, neither does anyone else here, so I fit right in. And instead, there are people associated with it who are qualified to practice law. For example, this one lady he mentions in our interview, who's a big-shot barrister in London, and in fact, beyond that, is head of criminal law at the Commonwealth Secretariat at Marlborough House. I don't quite understand how being head of criminal, that's for the entire Commonwealth, the head of criminal law at the Commonwealth Secretariat at Marlborough House is also involved in this strange version of universal exports. And what was interesting about talking to George is that he knows all the tradecraft terms now, because eventually at some point you realize you're living in your own personal spy thriller. So you start to pick up on all those terms like dead drops and all the rest of it. And it turns out that everything they do in all the most cliched spy thrillers actually happens. Robert writes, "Hi, Mark. My due date for my second renewal is May 17th, and I won't miss it." Thrilled to hear that, Robert. Make sure you've got your MasterCard all paid off so that the old payment for the Mark Stein Club goes. If necessary, don't eat. Eat dog food. Prowl through dumpsters and see what you can find in there. But don't miss your club renewal, because we're glad to have you. In fact, Robert very kindly came to our show with Dennis Miller in Syracuse, New York. Came all the way from Ottawa. Which it was grand to see him. Could you say a bit about Tommy Robinson running for the European Parliament? He looks like the only genuine working class hero left in Britain. Thanks in advance. That phrase, working class hero, you don't actually hear much these days, Robert, which is interesting in itself, because the tribunes of the people in the Labour Party, the people who are supposed to be all for the masses, are instead a bunch of metrosexuals swigging their Sauvignon Blanc and plotting the global takeover of the planet in fashionable London wine bars. Actually, I don't even know whether they have wine bars. Well, they do. They have their Kensington wine rooms where Alexander Downer meets to drink with George Papadopoulos. I didn't actually know they still had wine bars in London. I thought it was a 1980s thing. But apparently, I don't doubt that that's probably owned by MI6 too. They just need a safe wine bar in which to entrap these guys. So they created the Kensington Wine Rooms. Anyway, who knows? But Tommy Robinson is standing, Robert, not running for the European Parliament in the Westminster system, which one assumes even the degraded and pathetic Euro elections, in which the electors of the United Kingdom are apparently obliged to participate. One stands for Parliament, one runs for Congress. Let's keep these things distinct, Robert. Tommy Robinson is standing for the European Parliament. As I've written, he's been milkshaked. It's becoming a thing now to slam milkshakes into his heads. He's under severe threat. Not to be too paranoid about these things, but there's a lesson to what the British state keeps suing him, keeps dragging him into court, keeps prosecuting him, keeps jailing him, essentially for nothing, for things that other people can do with impunity, not least big shot mouthy imams get to do with impunity. And the reason is because I think I said on a recent Stein post that political correctness is about not noticing, about not noticing. So, for example, if you go and watch a trans, a girls' school sports thing in Connecticut, you're not supposed to notice that, in fact, the three first-placed winners in the track events all used to be boys until 6 months ago. You're not supposed to notice that in fact, the girls' sports are all being won by people who are biologically boys. It's all about not noticing. And Tommy Robinson made the mistake of refusing to not notice one of the biggest things at all, which is the child sex slavery rampant in almost every English town now, whether it's Rochdale or Rotherham in Lancashire and Yorkshire, or whether it's towns that didn't even exist half a century ago, like Telford in Shropshire, which is what they call one of these new towns, that all the girls are being taken into sex slavery, as you know. I've written about it and talked about it. And Tommy Robinson is determined not to let this simply be one of these things that Britain's ruling class agrees not to notice, because actually that's evil. And again, it's about the magnitude of the implications, because the horror of what is happening to these so-called quote-unquote white slags, i.e. these people that the British state have written off, that they're teenage girls, actually often pre-teenage girls, who have no fathers in the home. They're being raised by single mums. They're the product of the collapse of the family in some ways. And they are preyed upon by these Muslim, quote-unquote, grooming gangs, which is itself a euphemism, as I said, for sort of gang rapists. And the police and the political class and everyone else turns a blind eye to it. And the British state requires you to turn a blind eye to it, because otherwise you'd want to know why politicians from both parties enabled these conditions to arise in previously harmonious societies. And Tommy Robinson isn't going along with that. And he's standing in the European Parliament. I don't know what chances he has of winning, but certainly... And, you know, people are sort of iffy and fussy about the, you know, UKIP got too close to him and the Brexit Party isn't getting close to him. And my friends at The Spectator, for example, most of them seem to assume he's a bad thing by his very nature. But accepting for the purposes of argument that everything that's said about him is true, the fact is, what the state is doing is worse, because when the state singles out an individual for non-stop torment, that is not the actions of a free state. So we shall see how Tommy Robinson does in the European Parliament. But I'm with Douglas Murray on this. You know, Douglas and I and Tommy Robinson, we would be an awkward fit if we were in a pub in Luton with Tommy Robinson, because he's a working class guy and a lot of these things are just pure class snobbery, as you saw in his interview with Jeremy Paxman on the BBC a couple of years ago when he rang rings around the lethargic Paxo, basically because Paxo assumed that as some stupid yob from the gutter, a chap like Paxman could run rings around him, and it didn't happen. But the fact is that when Douglas and I get together and we, you know, and we're being effete and languid and decadent and all the rest of it, we nevertheless agree that the state's obsession with Tommy Robinson is a dark and disturbing development in English justice. So we wish Tommy Robinson well And it would be a big, it'd be a big up yours to the establishment if he were to get elected to the European Parliament. I don't know how that's going to, I don't know what the odds of that are. The fascinating thing about that is the Brexit Party right now is higher in the opinion polls than Conservative and Labour combined. The Brexit Party is actually running ahead of the Conservative Party in polls for the next British general election too. And I'll just say this, you know, you can say a lot of things about Nigel Farage, but he's a strategist, and he sees this as the moment to destroy the Tory party. And there's a lot to be said for taking advantage of moments like that. As Rahm Emanuel likes to say, never let a crisis go to waste. And he didn't let Theresa May's Brexit crisis go to waste. He now thinks he can destroy the British Tory party. And good luck to him on that, because in its recent incarnation, it's an utterly useless body. And I would apply that to the same Republican Party that is dragging Trump's kids before Senate committees for a matter that has already been adjudicated. Get the hell out of these people's lives. And I understand in the House, the Democrats run everything. And so they can keep the Russia investigation going for as long as they want, because that's the American way. The process is the punishment. The Senate is supposed to be Republican. And when you have a Republican Senate issuing subpoenas to a supposedly Republican president's children, something's wrong. And I would advise Trump to think about doing a Farage, as Nigel Farage is, and seizing the moment to destroy the... There are basically three forces in American political life at the moment. There's the Democrats, there's the Republicans, and there's Trump. And if the Republicans want to align themselves with Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler on the Russia investigation, then Trump should just get on with it and destroy the bloody useless Republican Party. Just my thoughts on that. And this is on that similar theme. L writes, our county supervisors from Fairfax, Virginia, recently voted to spend $200,000 of tax dollars to defend illegal aliens who are fighting deportation. How do we stop this insanity? My property taxes go up and up and up. Well, the Democrats have made a bet. But the Democrats and about half the Republican Party, including the Bill Kristol, never Trump Republican Party's, Koch brothers Republican Party, have essentially made a bet that that the future of America lies with non-Americans. you take somebody like Bill Kristol, who likes the idea of the American Constitution, American ideas, but thinks that American ideas are somehow float free. America's values float free of Americans, so that somehow it's like a magic airport gate that I often say, you know, the view of these people is that a nation is no more than Gate 37 at JFK. It's just a collection of whoever happens to be standing in it at that particular time. But it actually goes beyond that, because they claim that you can just rotate in and out people from Gate 37 and JFK, but that the land, the tiles on the floor, the perfume arising from simply the space, the physical space of Gate 28, Gate 37, is enough to transmute these mystical American values, which arise not from the mystic cords of memory, as Lincoln puts it, not from any deep roots, but are just there, like hanging over a physical location like smog, and just descending on whoever happens to be standing there at any one time. So it's more convenient of the two parties in America, one and a half of those parties think that they can non-Americans make better Americans than you do, L. And unless Americans actually understand that at a time when we have downward mobility in large parts of this country, not in Fairfax, Virginia, because you're in DC, you get the wealth spilling out from the imperial capital, instead of taking care, a government's first duty is to its people. When they prefer other people's people to their own people, something's up. Michael Seth writes, Mark, congratulations on your second year. I'm having trouble envisioning a post-Trump world. He's been a great and necessary reprieve, hopefully remaining until 2024. But what then? How can we ever return to an establishment candidate? Can America keep churning out quality independent candidates? Is there hope if we don't? Thanks also, by the way, for the tip on the Flashman series of books. They're wonderful. That's from Mike in Rockaway, New Jersey. I'm glad you're enjoying those Flashman books, because once you read, I mean, what I love about those books is that you could read analyses, and it doesn't matter who it is, actually. It doesn't matter whether it's from the Pentagon or from the European Union or whoever on, say, Afghanistan. But if you actually read Flashman in Afghanistan 150 years ago, that's all you ever need to know about Afghanistan. If you only ever read one thing about Afghanistan, make it Flashman's romps through that benighted land. You make a great point, Michael. The problem here is that Trump is an individual, and there's two sort of theories on that. There's people who say, that Republicans voted for Trump despite his personality. My friend Ann Coulter has sort of come around to that view in a certain sense, in that she believes people put up with Trump's distinctive personality because he was the only person talking about anything that mattered to them. That in an aesthetic sense, you might well have preferred it if Jeb or John Kasich or Marco Rubio or Mitt Romney or John McCain or Bob Dole or any of the House-trained Republicans had been talking about anything like that. But they weren't. They'd flown the coop. They'd abandoned that ground. So this guy, a real estate developer with a reality show, comes along and you're so disgusted at the failures of your party, which for your entire adult life has been promising to do things if it gets into office and never doing them. And it doesn't matter whether you mean even just small things like abolishing the Federal Department of Energy or the Federal Department of Education. It's got this fantastic platform, and the day it gets elected, it tosses that platform back in the bottom of the filing cabinet for the next 4 years. So these guys haven't done anything. And so you go for Trump despite himself. And then there's another theory which says that it's actually Trump's personality is essential to him being able to do things like talk about Mexican rapists, because it's only a guy of a certain size who can say that stuff and survive. And so Trump, you can't sort of split between Trump's policies and Trump's personality. One is essential to the other. And it's true to the extent that we haven't yet seen anybody other than Trump do that and prosper. But I think I see no reason why he. I think it's not. No, it's more than that. It's not. I see no reason. It's necessary that someone demonstrate that, because, for example, if we were to go back in 2024 to some Jeb Marco type character, they would lose. They would lose, and I don't think there's much of a future in that. So that's an interesting conundrum. That we found. I'll say something which also, I think this came up in one of the comments on the George Papadopoulos thing, because it's an important part of that. Trump ought to have been easy to get because he's been doing business in New York his entire life. And New York is a stinking dump of corruption. We all know that. It's a corrupt city. It's a corrupt city where people are on the take, and if you want to do business in that city, you've got to know your way around the stinking sewers of New York politics and New York regulation and New York bureaucracy. And someone pointed out earlier this morning that Geraldine Ferraro, for example, when Walter Mondale was running for president in whatever it was, 1984, and he had Geraldine Ferraro as his running mate, her husband had been in business in New York, and they were, and just by that very nature, he had involved himself in slimy and seamy and dubious business dealings, that they were able to hang around Mrs. Ferraro's neck and by implication around Walter Mondale's. And so what's amazing to me is that if there had been obvious dirt on Trump from his business life, they could have found that out in 20 minutes. He's in New York, hung it around his neck and killed his campaign. And that is why Russia and George Papadopoulos are important. The Russia investigation was partly designed to distract from the fact that the only candidate colluding with Russia was Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton paid an ex, so-called, or, yeah, not ex, right, believe that if you want, an MI6 guy called Christopher Steele to work his Moscow Rolodex and get all this dirt from his so-called contacts in Russia, who may well have been playing him and playing Hillary Clinton. Nobody knows. But the fact is, the only person colluding with the Russians in among those candidates was Hillary Clinton, who was paying Christopher Steele to work his Moscow Rolodex. And so they needed to come up with an operation that would distract from that. So they decided simply to switch the Russian collusion from Hillary over to Trump. They did something else, too, as I think I said in my interview with Papadopoulos. There are dirty people around Trump. I mean, the thing about Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen, for example, is you know these are guys who have been doing sleazy stuff all their lives. So the trouble there, if you're trying to stitch them up, it's really difficult trying to pin, like, murky Russian collusion on someone like Manafort or Cohen. That's why you can only get them on process crimes, because if you try to set them up at the heart of the Russian collusion thing, you're trying to impose fake sleaze on all their real sleaze. And that's actually trickier than it sounds. It's much easier to take a 28-year-old kid like George Papadopoulos, who's a blank slate, who's this squeaky clean Washington policy wonk, and put him in a foreign country, and then basically on that blank slate paint an entirely fictional version of events. It's much more difficult to do that because if you accuse, if you were to accuse, say, Paul Manafort of colluding with Putin's second cousin in St. Petersburg in March of 2016, he'd say, oh, no, I wasn't colluding with Putin's second cousin, because in March of 2016, I was colluding with a Kazakh oligarch. It's necessary for the deep state scheme to have a blank slate on which you can print your own fictional narrative. John Schuber writes, this is so sad. Mark, I don't know if you will get the chance, but if you have time, could you comment on the decision of Bowling Green State University, just south of me, to remove the name Gish from the Gish Theatre on the BGSU campus? This was initially endowed by Lillian Gish about 40 years ago. Both she and her sister Dorothy were BGSU alums. It was then in the early 1900s, back when it was the Bowling Green Teachers College. And a collection of Gish memorabilia was also housed at the theatre. And we're talking here about one of the... Dorothy didn't have quite as impressive a career as Lillian, but they were great American actresses of the screen and stage. And Lillian, in particular, was called the First Lady of American Cinema, because she was the one who, way back in the first silent film, big time successful silent film shorts, we're going back around 1910, 1915 now, pioneered a lot of the techniques that we now take for granted in film acting. She appeared in films that we still watch, still turn up, at least on the classic movies channels, Duel in the Sun and the Night of the Hunter. And she was working basically up until about 30 years ago, she died in, I'm trying to remember now, she died about a quarter century ago, I would say, and she was working up until 5 years before the end, in her 90s, a tremendous career. But this collection from her life that she gave to her old alma mater, Bowling Green State University, the Gish Theatre on the BGSU campus, the Black Student Union discovered that, what are we now, 2019? 104 years ago, Lillian Gish appeared in Birth of a Nation. So in a career that lasted till 1990, this was her only, as John Schuber says, this was the only brush with arguably racist material in the long and storied lives of the sisters. It was particularly interesting in that Lillian was not just an acclaimed actress, but was also a producer, writer, and director. She is regarded as one of the 20th century's greatest film and stage actresses. So where was the feminist brigade in all this? Not a peep. And you're right, John. And actually, one of the there's a small, fascinating little story of Hollywood is that everyone assumes we should do something special on this, actually, because it is quite an interesting aspect of American entertainment. But everyone assumes when you hear about Harvey Weinstein, for example, that the old Hollywood casting couch is still in effect. And in a certain sense, the people who purport to be sophisticated and cynical say that, well, you know, everyone's known Hollywood has a casting couch, and you got to put out if you want to get the big role in the chick flick. You got to put out for Harvey Weinstein and give his incredibly hirsute back a rub down with appropriately pungent massage oil once in a while. Why are you making such a big deal? You want to work in Hollywood? Why are you making such a big deal when the guy takes you up to his room and then mysteriously, just after pouring you a glass of champagne, emerges from the bathroom with his robe open? But in fact, and that's, there is a casting couch, and that is true. But actually, at the dawn of Hollywood, it wasn't. And when you look at Mary Pickford, for example, one of the co-founders of United Artists, or Lillian Gish, in fact, there was a period when it was, in fact, one of the most enlightened, genuinely enlightened, when it came to opportunities for women, one of the most enlightened industries compared not just to others, but compared to the way it became under the likes of Harvey Weinstein. And so when John Schuber says, where's the feminist brigade in this? Feminism is dead. In case you haven't noticed, women, as identity politics starts to codify itself into a hierarchy of privilege, feminism is moving lower and lower down. So feminists are not going to defend Lillian Gish because they understand that race trumps women in this occasion. Just as feminists have understood, they've gone all silent on transgender issues because they understand that transgender trumps sex, trumps feminism. so that women with penises are higher than on the identity politics hierarchy than women without penises. If you're a woman without a penis, you're screwed. You're not getting anything. You're slipping further and further down the identity politics hierarchy, and they understand that, and they understand that. So you won't find... So a genuine feminist pioneer, Lillian Gish, will find no supporters. And John quotes his local rag about what the investigation that led to the extermination of the Gish name. Quote, "It also found that while the Gish sisters do not appear to have been advocates for racist or exclusionary practices or perspectives, the content and historical impact of an actor's work should be taken into account. The task force stated it could not find documentation that Lillian Gish ever denounced the themes of the film or distanced herself from the director or his views." So Lillian Gish has been vaporized from Bowling Green State University because on Robert Mueller grounds, you know, oh yeah, we couldn't convict him. We can't find her guilty. But the absence of evidence of her guilt is insufficient. Because we have not been able to find evidence that she is innocent, we have to destroy her and her legacy. These are evil people. The people who are tearing down statues, the people who are renaming theatres, the people who are doing this are evil people determined to make us live in the totalitarianism of year zero. And you can never be up to speed enough, because when it's always year zero, you eventually wind up like Alyssa Milano, thinking it's woke to advocate that women withdraw from sex because you've essentially adopted Queen Victoria's view of sexual relations, that it's not something in which a woman can ever derive pleasure from. You just have to lie back and think of England, as her apocryphal advice to her daughter put it. In this case, Alyssa Milano says, you just got to lie back and think of Planned Parenthood, or don't lie back because of Planned Parenthood, that there is no possibility that women can derive sexual pleasure. It's the death of feminism. It's the death of feminism, because the internal contradictions of identity politics are too much. Richard Malaby writes, "Hello, Mark, and a great big happy birthday to the club. I'm going with the full name from now on, Richard Malaby." That's Richard Malaby. So if Brian Sims attempts to dox me too, he can eat his heart out. "I realise you're not one for the political horse race, who's up and who's down, but you get the big picture right. Trump, immigration, Muslim, European demography. I'm trying to think big picture for Mark Stein. Where do you think this Michael Mann case ends? That is there any verdict on the horizon, and do you have any feelings on which way it will go? I'd like to believe liberty and common sense will prevail, but seeing as you're going on almost a decade in this ordeal, I can't let myself be that naive." Well, we've got some kind of scheduling conference, or whatever the hell they call it, with the new judge. As I've said before, two judges, the first two trial judges on this thing have retired. I forget the name of the third judge, and I'm not even sure it's worth remembering it because, you know, she'll be retiring soon. And then we'll be on to the fourth judge. This thing now is going to the Supreme Court before it ever goes back down to the lower court for the actual trial. I could explain that, but I'd have to stab my eyeballs out with a pencil. The best estimate from my lawyer is that it's going to be 10 years before the thing is ever finally wrapped up, because it's not a priority to the Supreme Court. So it's going to be Michael Mann versus estate of Mark Stein by the time this thing is done. I'm not happy about that, no. As I always say, whenever I find myself in an American courthouse, I like the old express checkout that Chogosh got after he shot McKinley. 6 weeks after he shot McKinley, they're frying the guy. Boy, I'd give anything for that system. But that is that kind of swift justice is lost to America. Kent W. writes, congratulations, and thank you for 2 years of the Mark Stein Club. When you announce an upcoming Clubland Q&A, I always find it fascinating when you list some of the remote places around the globe where members are located. This is truly the club on which the sun never sets. Can you tell us how many countries are represented by MSC members? Is it over 100? Just curious. I'll tell you, well, I'm very, not to be, to state the obvious, but obviously most of our members are from English-speaking countries. That's to say they're from current or former corners of Her Majesty's dominion. So obviously the United States, Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, but there are something like 60 English-speaking countries in the world. So we also get to Mauritius, and we get to the Solomon Islands, and we get to Vanuatu and the Cook Islands, and we're thrilled and delighted to have all those folks on board. We do have some dark patches, as indeed the British Empire. So although we are an internet empire on which the sun never sets, but we do have our like dark zones. We have members in Latin America, not as many as I'd like, and I would certainly appreciate if you're minded, if you're in South America and minded to enroll, then I'd love to hear from you. We have parts of Francophone Africa where we are underrepresented, and I would certainly appreciate a few more from there. And there's certain of the the sort of B-list stands in Central Asia, where we don't have members, possibly because I call them B-list stands. I take that back. Whichever stan you're in is an A-list stan to us. So come and stan with us, and we'll stan with you. But thank you. We would like to get all 200 countries, but I think it's actually rather hard to get hold of us in certain of the more oppressive Muslim regimes and North Korea and so forth. Mick Wenlock says, howdy, Mark. Happy second birthday to the club and happy to have re-upped. I am an expat Brit and now a US citizen. Glad I have managed to miss out on the blood pressure of increasing Brexit betrayal. What I wondered, Mark, is whether you think that if the Brits still adhered to the rights that they had under Cromwell and Charles II, would the government have dared to go against the wishes of 50% of the population? Never was the lack of the power of the sword more apparent than in this last 18 months. I'm always a bit wary of advocating civil war, Mick. But at a certain point, when the political class is treating you with total contempt, which is essentially what has happened at Westminster since the Brexit vote, then something has to give. And the Brexit referendum was called because the parties, roughly speaking, half the country wanted out of the European Union. And that had been consistent for 20 years before the referendum. But there was no party to represent that position in Parliament. Unless you count Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, which until it too got high on all the EU moolah, was officially anti-EU. But of course, the thing about Sinn Féin MPs is they don't take their seats because they don't want to take the oath of allegiance to the Queen, which you have to do before you sit in Parliament. And so as a result of that, they don't get to sit in Parliament. So even if you voted for Sinn Féin, those guys aren't going to be there to get you out of the EU. And anyway, as I said, they're now all suckling on the Brussels teat and have changed their position on that. So the mainstream parties did not get the message after the Brexit vote that that the people and the parties that represent them in Parliament are misaligned, and that in that situation, in a nation of representative government, it is for the parties to get back on side with the people. Instead, the great subversion of Brexit began. And so now what we're seeing now in the European elections, for example, as I said, these polls show that Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, which was just formed a month ago, now has more than the votes, is polling higher than the Conservative Party and the Labour Party combined. So the Conservative Party is going to be devastated if that holds until next week. I believe the Euro elections are on, it's the day before Victoria Day. So what are we today? May 23rd, 13, 14, 15, I think it's next Thursday. It's 8 days' time. So if he clobbers the Tories, then people say, oh, it's the European elections. Who cares? Doesn't matter. We weren't even supposed to be voting in them. So the only people who want to vote in them are the people who are mad about Brexit. OK, well, then we have these polls for the next UK general election, which show that in some of them, the Brexit Party has been outpolling the Tories. Again, that would be a wipeout for the Conservative Party if that were to hold, even though the beneficiary would, in some senses, not be the Brexit Party, but would be Labour, or in certain seats, the Liberal Democrats or the Scottish Nationalists or whoever. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. At some point, unless you want to take up arms, at a certain point, all you can do is inflict total humiliation. So that you put all these people out of Parliament. It's in the most humiliating fashion. They never get back in again. But as I said, otherwise, Mick, in terms of social tranquility, it's going to go very oddly. Ray Winchester, another of our United Kingdom members, writes, I used to think the USA was just nasty for not helping us when World War II started. That's for our American listeners, for our European and Commonwealth listeners, the Second World War begins in 1939, and it always slightly discombobulates me when I hear that someone in the United States talking about the Second World War breaking out in 1941. No, for the rest of us, it was over 2 years earlier. But Ray says he's forgiven you for that now. I absolutely know why now. The duplicitous Europeans, including the UK Westminster swamp, Macron now says today he will block UK, which means US also, getting contracts for the future EU army. The EU has plans to build an army. I think it may be the world's smallest army. I don't know how serious this EU army is. But 75% of the military in Eastern Europe protecting the EU are the United States. Ray says, after these idiotic statements from Macron that the USA should repatriate them. This goes back over half a century to when de Gaulle pulled out of the military wing of NATO. I don't understand. There's a decadence to this, because it only works because everything in America is so ossified, so that there's a big room in the Pentagon basement where they're still making plans for an invasion by the Soviet Union of the East German plain. Via the East German plain into West Germany, even though the Soviet Union, East Germany, and West Germany no longer exists as states. The money's been allocated to all this war gaming on the German plain And so you can't stop it once it's started. Even though those nations no longer exist, that money's been allocated and can't be stopped. But the fact is that by absolving wealthy nations of the need to defend themselves, you let a kind of decadence set in, as in the European Union. So I think they should actually, if they want to create an EU army independent of NATO, then I think they should be encouraged to go ahead and do it. And I think the United States should pull out. Rummy was the last guy who ever seriously, Rumsfeld used to talk about this from time to time, and they'd always object, saying, oh yeah, like in Germany, they'd always, oh yes, there are these bases, they don't really have any military function now. There's no strategic goal that these bases in Germany are in support of, but it would be bad for the local economy, for German supermarkets, if all the American soldiers were to go home. And I sympathize. I wouldn't want to be a German supermarket owner when the US military base closes down. But the fact is that by absolving the Europeans of the need to pay for their own defense, the United States has encouraged this kind of poser geopolitics where like some dinky little male mannequin from some French menswear store, Macron puts his hand on his hip and strikes a geopolitical attitude, disconnected entirely. And Frau Merkel, Mrs. Merkel, Mutti Merkel does the same. Again, absolved of the need to actually put the money where the mouths are. And that's gone on too long. Walt Trimmer brings it back to our show with George Papadopoulos. What do you suppose the odds are that George Papadopoulos' communications were being monitored by the NSA? Oh, that's a 100% certainty. And indeed, our colleague Andrew, who helped set up, because I'm, you know, not a big emailer or all the rest of it. So Andrew, who set up the interview with George Papadopoulos for me and was writing to George, and George is writing back to him. Andrew is a poor Canadian. And he said to me rather mordantly that he now expects, because the fact that he's emailing with George Papadopoulos, he's now in the system. So the NSA are monitoring him. And he thinks that the next time he crosses the US border at Windsor, Detroit, or whichever bridge he happens to choose, Niagara Falls, wherever it is, that he's going to be hauled over the coals, because he's going to be in the NSA database now. These guys are surveilling us all the time. They knew all this. George Papadopoulos, I can't remember whether he said it on camera or off camera, but he said immediately when the FBI turned up around his turned up outside his mother's house and said where he got a telephone call on his cell phone. He said, hi, this is the FBI. We've got the house surrounded right now. Can you open the door and let us in so we can destroy your life? And he understood from that first moment that, in fact, they'd been monitoring him for months. This is pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. You know, today we've just said a thing saying it's not safe for Americans to be in Iraq. So all the non-essential personnel are being pulled out of the embassy. The world's biggest and best protected embassy in the Green Zone in Baghdad are having to be pulled out because 16 years after that war, it's not even safe to be in the US embassy. They can't do anything for that. They can't do anything for Afghanistan, where we've been running around pointlessly for 18 years. They can't do anything for Libya, where since the genius Obama Hillary intervention, any kind of functioning government has collapsed, and those ports are just being run by ISIS affiliates now. Can't do anything for that. But they can get George Papadopoulos and anyone who emails with him. These are pointless and stupid agencies, and we should be concerned by their abuses of power. Jill Felsen writes, "Hi, Mark. Like many other Mark Steyn Club members, I love the novels, short stories and poems. Many are familiar since I spend a large amount of time hanging around in the Victorian Edwardian age." You're fabulously well preserved for your age, Jill. You must tell me your secret. Is it moisturiser? But what strikes me in all of them is how they each, in their way, teach the English-speaking world of today so definitively, so clearly, what has been lost. Even a space alien dropping in could tell quickly what the inhabitants of this world believed in, what they honoured, what they despised, an actual culture that believed in itself. Well, except for some Marxists, anarchists, etc. We clubbers here, of course, are mainly the proverbial choir, but do you think there is any way these wonderful pieces of literature could be tools to reach the deeply misinformed and misguided parts of our culture, especially the young people who, as far as I can tell, have no idea? Even so, I love that you have put so much into bringing them to us. Bravo, says Jill. Thank you for that, Jill. I mean it sincerely. And as I often say, I started doing it because I'm shocked. When I was at school, there's always a contrarian streak among youth. So with the heady confidence of a 15, 16-year-old, it's quite natural to despise and the great civilizational inheritance to which you are heir. But even to despise it, you have to know it, as opposed to these ludicrous tosspots who are chiseling Lillian Gish's name off everything at Bowling Green State University. You have to know it. Even to despise it, you have to know it. I'm actually shocked. With my own kids, I was totally shocked by how undemanding. I don't know whether it's just American high school. Maybe it's the same in Canada. Maybe it's the same all over the world. But how undemanding high school was and how little they had in their cultural vocabulary at the end of it. It makes it very difficult. You don't have to be religious. You don't have to be an observant Christian, for example, to read P.G. Woodhouse, but you have to have a familiarity with scripture. Otherwise, you don't get a big chunk of the jokes in there. You have to have a broad familiarity with the weight of history. Otherwise, when he's making jokes about Damon and Pythias or whatever, it's all just funny names. And I find it's not that it's undisturbing in one sense, but it's also that instead of teaching, for example, the poems we do are, for good or ill, real poems. They're not the modish pap with which poetry has been replaced in the average high school. And that likewise goes for a lot of the novels that we do too. That I'm sad that kids can graduate from grade 12 or whatever it is and not have become acquainted with any of these poems. I'm also sad as well because of the death of the middle brow, a broad middle brow culture. I'm not talking about some great artistic work, but just saying that basic middle brow culture should in some senses be supportive of one's civilizational inheritance. It's one of the most important things we do, because that's the ultimate glory of Western civilization, that we have produced incredible architecture. We have produced incredible paintings. We have produced incredible plays and novels and operas and symphonies and poems. And in the rubble of our and the ruins of our civilization today, there is the hollowness. It's not as if these things are being replaced and supplanted. they're being, as at Bowling Green State University, they're being vaporized and nothing replaces them. And eventually there'll be a great black hole in which we will be too stupid even to know what we've lost. So I thank you for that, Jill, and we intend to keep on doing it, and we will be doing it this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then don't forget, at the beginning of next week, as I said, I'm going to be got some radio obligations and all the rest of it, but we will have part two of our big special with George Papadopoulos. And it's actually heartrending what he says in that part of the show towards the end. I still think about it. It's truly terrible what the deep state spy agencies of at least three nations did to that guy. And we will explore that with George Papadopoulos in the Mark Steyn Show at the beginning of next week. Thank you for all your questions. As you know, we always like to save some of them and pick up on them in a special video edition of Mark's Mailbox, which we will do. But thank you for them all. And we will see you next time.